Good morning. So last time we covered some sort of syntax for HTLS, which is going to be sort of how we describe hardware. We discussed this idea of, we're like talking about wires that hold values. We have this equal sign to represent a connection between two wires. So it's not an assignment. And in particular, it doesn't happen at some particular time. Something is connected or it isn't, and that affects how everything around it behaves. And we talked about one sort of consequence of this is that if we just had a loop in our sort of circuit that calculated things, we had this instability. And we saw an issue last week, we could write calculations with just logic, and the assumption is that would turn into gates or the appropriate hardware you might learn about in 2030. To do the calculation, we can do that, but if we want to sort of do iteration, we need some extra help. And our sort of first component for this was something called a register. So for the register, we have this thing that stores data. And why do we want to store data? Well, if we want to first do one thing and then do another thing, a way we can do that is by storing information about what we're doing in the first step and then switching it to storing different information for the second step. And this is sort of the basic design we're going to use for our processor. And to control when the registers change what they're storing, we're going to have this clock signal. And that clock signal is going to be shared across our entire circuit. So if we have a bunch of registers in our circuit, they're all going to use the same clock signal. And I kind of drew out our clock signal as we have this kind of shape. This is traditionally sort of what would it would look like if you plotted the voltage over time. And we said the registers we're using, the way they're going to work is they're going to look for these rising edges of the clock signal. And at that time, they're going to read in their input and store a new output. And the value they're storing, that's always what they're outputting. And then we talked about some other components we're going to need. So we're going to make a processor. We need to read instructions. So we need to get the instructions machine code. We talked about what the machine code looked like earlier. And to get the instructions, we need some component that holds all the instructions. And for our processor, that's going to be in the instruction memory. And we're going to try to, abstract that right now. We'll talk more about like what's really going on later. But the way we're abstracting is that we have some component where we put in an address on a signal called PC, and we get out the sort of value at that address on a signal called i10 bytes. We chose to call it i10 bytes because for our processor, we want 10 bytes of instruction data for the biggest instruction. If we have smaller instructions, we're just not going to use them. And finally, we looked at building a CPU that just does nops and talked about what running that would look like, and we'll probably just do a demo of that sort of after we get through questions. So things people have questions about. I guess also I will say I have slides prepared about some of the quiz questions if you have those questions, but I'm going to assume if people don't ask, you don't need to know that. Yeah?
We never went over the week two quiz, and
Quiz 3?
I'm saying quiz 2 we never talked about.
So my policy for that is I'm not going to go over the whole quiz. If you have a specific question you want me to go over, I'll do that. Okay. So if anyone has specific questions about like a quiz question, specific quiz question, I'm not going to go over a whole quiz because I don't think that usually is not a great use of time. Yeah?
Question 3.
So question 3 on the last quiz. Sure. So in question 2 and 3 on the quiz, we were asking you to sort of swap the most and the two most significant and least significant bytes of a 32-bit number. I believe 32-bit? Yeah. And then clear the second least significant byte. And a way we can look at this is that for the swapping operation, we can kind of think of this as three parts. That first we need to move the upper bits to the lower bits, then we need to move the lower bits to the upper bits, and then we need to keep all the bits that aren't being affected the same, but clear the other bits because we want to overwrite them. So that's our three parts, and the sort of shifting is and masking is like we select those bits and shift them to the right place, and then we want to do this masking to extract all the bits we didn't change. Okay. So that's the first thing we wanted to do. The other thing we wanted to do is we wanted to clear the second least significant byte. So a way we could have done that is by masking with a mask which has zeros where that byte is and ones everywhere else, and that's that mask. Now the problem is we want to do both these operations at the same time, and the code we were given only ends once. So how can we deal with this? Well, we can think of it as we wanted to do sort of our result and this first value, and then and that with this second value, but the way AND works, that's the same as ending our result with both values. So that's one way we could have thought about it. Another way, both values AND is together. So another way we could think about it is if we think of combining these two masking operations, I want to extract all but the first two bits, the last two bits, and that byte. And we construct a mask that way. And either way, we get this mask where I need to need to copy my work correctly and put a C here. Questions about that? Yes?
So we use the mask to, what do you know to shift like 30 bits right and 30 bits left? Like I know that 30 bits clears everything but the two bits that we want, but why do you do it like that?
So the question is, why am I shifting 30 bits left and right in this question? So we were asked to move the two most significant bits. So we have our number here. I wanted to move these bits over to the beginning of the number. And I counted how many places that was, and that was 3. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Can I explain answer choices A and B? Okay, so I need to remember what A is since I didn't have the impression that that wasn't on my short list. And it slides about. So this was about risk versus CISC, so I should pull up the slide I have, which mentions some risk versus CISC things. So A was, so this is about which was more consistent with the risk philosophy. And in the risk philosophy, so I guess I don't have a specific example of that. So, but in the risk philosophy, right, risk is about kind of expose what hardware can do. Hardware can do versus CISC is like first for convenience of assembly. And the first option on the quiz, option A, was that we wanted to allow all instructions to specify locations in memory to make the instruction set more uniform. So this is going to be more difficult for hardware because now it means we need to like have a memory calculation and fetching for memory on every instruction. And that's not going to be, and we're going to have the machinery to handle every instruction doing that, which means that we're not going to be able to implement the instructions quite as efficiently, or at least quite as simply. Maybe as efficiently, but not as simply. And we mentioned in class that RISC instruction sets typically have separate instructions for accessing memory. So even though it's more uniform, that's kind of a, this is a convenient if you're writing assembly thing. It's not more convenient if you're implementing the hardware. Because if we're implementing the hardware, we'd rather have treat kind of accessing memory similar to like multiplying, and that it's something an instruction can do as kind of a special operation, not as the norm. The second option here is including an instruction that does a logical right shift. So we want to expose that we can manipulate the bits in hardware, and a logical right shift instruction is a great way of doing that. So it's like, it's a really simple operation to implement in hardware, and kind of our assumption by exposing it is that the compiler will figure out how to use it. And we kind of saw the examples of that in like, compiler will do division with it, even if we aren't writing code directly. Does that answer your question? Well, yeah.
Would you mind going over the first one?
And question one? Yes, and that one I have a slide on. Okay, so for question one, we're doing this, we're taking a value, and the value shifted over by one, and we want a particular result. And I've kind of written out the bits of it here. So if like doing this calculation bit by bit, and I can say, well, if I think of what happens when I shift by one, since it's an arithmetic shift, I'm duplicating the highest bit, and all the other bits move over. And I can kind of compute symbolically the highest bit. Well, two things XORed together are zero. And then I have these two bits XORed together, and so on. And this just gives me a system of equations to solve. And something I can observe is that when I see, when I see something like this, this means that x2 doesn't equal x3 because of how XOR works. So I can kind of say, so to solve this, I can do something where I choose one of the bits to set to 0 or 1, and then I can figure out based on these sorts of, if it's 1, they're not equal, and if it's 0, they are equal. I can find all the bits. And there's two possible answers depending on whether I choose that bit to be 0 or 1 that I start with. So in my work here, I said, oh, I noticed that x3 must be the same as everything up to x60 because they're all XOR together to get 0. And then I have these relationships between x3 and all the other bits based on the XORs telling me 1 means they're opposite, 0 means they're the same. And then I just choose x3 to be either 0 or 1 and figure out what all the other bits are based on. Questions? Yes?
Can you expand quiz 2, question 2?
Quiz 2, question 2. Where did I put my window for? Oh, I probably put my window over here. Yes. So quiz 2, question 2. So question 2 is saying, is asking what the symbol table entry we get for print error does in this file. So we have relocations, we talked about, and symbol table entries. So relocations are the things that indicate where we have a placeholder that needs to be filled in. And symbol table entries are what indicates things that those placeholders might point to. So if we look at our assembly code above, this is a placeholder that might need to be filled in. Because in the machine code, we're not going to know exactly where in memory error table is going to end up. This is a placeholder that's going to need to be filled in, because in the machine code, we're not going to know where printf is going to end up until we make the actual executable. We make the object file, we aren't going to know it. This is not a placeholder, because we're not going to generate any machine code for that. It's just going to be, you know, that's just a marker that indicates where the LEA that we want to start when we do print error stuff is. And the information about that marker, that thing that my other files might refer to, that's going to be in the symbol table entry. And so the symbol table entry is going to have where the LEA instruction is, and it's going to have the location in the object file because, well, we haven't decided where it is in memory yet, so we can't have the memory address yet. And, you know, we could put it in different places depending what executable it ends up being linked into. And it needs to specifically be for the LEA because that's the instruction we want to run when we call print error. We don't want to go to the middle of the instruction. We want to go to the beginning. We don't want to run this call first. We want to run the LEA first. So it has to be for specifically that LEA. Yes?
So this is like similar to what we did for the lab last night.
So this is similar to what you did for the lab? Yes. Very similar.
Yeah. I really cannot understand because I think LEA is like a basic instruction. Because in the lab we only put what we created, but LEA is not recreated. Right.
Question, in the lab you only put what you created? What do you mean by created? So the question is, you don't know why other files would look for location LEA in this object file? So the reason why is that they do like call print error. And if we have a call print error, what we expect to happen is that call will save a return address on the stack and then start executing this LEA instruction. And so to make that possible, we better have information about where LEA is and label that with print error. So when we're looking for that, how to figure out how to make that call instruction works, we can go there. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yes, back there.
Mm-hmm.
Question 2 of this, of which quiz?
Of this quiz.
Quiz 2?
No, question 2 on this quiz. So.
This is quiz 2?
Yeah.
The quiz from last week. That, I thought, is what I was just talking about, which is why I was confused.
Oh, okay, sorry.
Question 4. So this was asking about finding the value of x here. So I have the work I did down here. So the thing we wanted to remember here is that the right shift is equivalent to division by a power of 2. We mentioned there's like some differences in rounding, depending on whether it's positive or negative. But an assumption we can kind of make when solving this is that, well, maybe the rounding will matter eventually. But if we get the exact answer without rounding, if it's like exactly right without rounding, we don't need to worry about the rounding. So I just wrote out the equation, and you solve it for x, and you get, just with algebra, the value of x. Where the trick was you just have to write out the equation using the fact that when I shift over 48, I'm dividing by 2 to the 48. Does that answer your question? And I guess an error problem some people had on this is that some people got this formula and then didn't compute it 2 to the 50th without, in a way, which lost precision. So, which... Yeah, just don't. If you lose precision, you'll not get the right answer.
Okay, please do question 3 specifically about the last line. Does the p bracket 4 change the pointers?
So the question is, in this C code here, does the p bracket 4 change the pointer? No, it computes a new address value, and uses that, but the original value of p remains unchanged. So, just like if I wrote like x plus 4, like, and pass that to a function that computes the value of x plus 4, but it doesn't change x.
God, thanks.
Yeah?
If that last line was, like, p1 equals 300, would it then change some of the bytes of p? But in this case, it's, like, off the end of, like,
so the question is, if this was p1 equals 300, would it change some of the bytes of p? So regardless of what, but P points to array, right? And because this is kind of, and because of this is the array indexing syntax, it uses P as a pointer. So all our changes are where P points, not to P itself. So it changes, in this case, it changes array of 14. But it's based on where P points. It doesn't change P. Yeah. Yes, right behind you. Yeah. For question one, can I?
Just the part where it's like, and x61 is not x60.
So the question is, how did I get these formulas here?
Oh, no, just like the last, yeah, the last line in that. Could you explain your logic for that? I think that was still.
Okay, so let's do this one first. So, so I know x61 doesn't equal x60. Why do I know that? Because when I XOR them together, I get 1. And I also have this from before, that x3 is equal to x60. And this is from just a chain of seeing that when I XOR 59 and 60, I get 0. When I XOR 58 and 59, I get 0. When I XOR, and so on. And so that gets me that x3 is equal to everything up to x60. And I'm using that here to say that if 61 is the opposite of, bit 61 is the opposite of bit 60, it's also the opposite of bit 3. Is that what you were confused about? Why is x3 equal to x59? Okay, so let's start with, do we believe x3 is equal to x4?
Yeah.
Okay, so x3 is equal to x4. And if I continue this diagram, we'd have another row, which was would be for 4, where I would say x4 XORed with x5 is 0. Does that make sense? And from that, I get that x4 is equal to x5. And I'm going to do that again and get x5 is equal to x6. And it's all the way up to x60. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so when we left off last time, we were talking about this sort of minimal processor that we said we would have. And let's sort of show you the slides for this, but let's do running this in our GLRS, which I had a window for. So here I have that code pre-written, and I have an assembly file I want to run. So first I'm going to assemble that into an executable. I'm going to make YAS exist, and I'm going to assemble that into an executable, and now we have an executable file. And then I'm going to run L, and right, we have 5 nops to run. So we'll just run that on that executable. And here we go. So we can see here that the simulator, it's showing us a bunch of things that will become relevant later. So one of them is that it's showing us the values of all the registers at each step. It counts cycle numbers, and between each cycle, there's a rising edge of the clock. So like RPC, for example, changes. And we can see the contents of the registers we've defined here. So remember, we defined a register, the PC. That's where the contents of it is. The simulator also prints out the value of the signal called PC, which is the input to the instruction memory. and therefore what we loaded from memory. And we actually loaded 10 bytes, but for your convenience for debugging, it prints out the disassembly of the instruction we loaded, and that's why it doesn't show all 10 bytes. Now you might say, wait a moment, I'm looking at this diagram here of the memory, and there's nothing at address 270D. And well, we don't show the parts of the memory that are uninitialized, and they're going to all be zeros. So we loaded zeros, zeros happened to be interpreted as a halt, and our processor just kept going. Well, why did it keep going? Well, because we didn't implement the halt instruction. So we probably want to do that. So let's talk about how we could implement the halt instruction. So if you remember when I talked about this sort of built-in stat signal, this is how we tell the simulator when to stop. And right now, we've set it to the constant, which represents keep going. So it's keeping going. And we don't change that even if when we load a halt instruction. Yeah, we have a halt instruction, but that information's here, and we're not doing anything with it. So we want to do something with it. We want to make a decision. And it seems like maybe kind of annoying to do that. And basically what we're asking to do is we're asking to somehow take the opcode and translate it to a stat value. And you could do this using the sort of techniques you learned in the bitwise homework. We're not going to have you do that. Our hardware programming language is going to have a shorthand because sort of automating this process, you know, converting this process to hardware, it's going to be fairly simple, so we're going to have a nice readable way of writing. And we're going to do that by kind of representing an important hardware component that we're going to use a whole bunch. And this component is something called a multiplexer. So this is going to be our hardware tool for if-then. So if you want to do kind of an if-then decision, this is the tool we're going to use. So this is kind of a box of logic, which takes in a bunch of value inputs, which I've labeled here A, B, C, and D, and produces an output. And how does it know which output to produce? Well, we have this select signal. So in this example, if my select signal is 0, I would get A. My select signal is 1, I would get B, and so on. And if you want to think about how to do this with bitwise operators, you could realize, oh, I could write a truth table, I could figure out how to turn this into a bunch of bitwise ands and so on, but we're going to kind of really abstract this MUX tool because we're going to have a syntax that kind of looks like an if-then-else, if-else-if-else-if-else-if syntax. But what's going to happen is that, you know, if we were building hardware, our hardware programming language implementation would compile it down to something which uses a MUX and has some logic that produces the correct select value based on the conditions we specify. So questions about what these MUXes do. Okay. So in HTLRS, MUXes look like this. The book calls this a case expression. And what this is representing, you can think of as we have input 1, 2, 3, and 4. Those are these values here. 4. And the hardware is going to build something which takes in X. Or not the idea is the programming language is representing that there's going to be some logic that implements these conditions we specify here. And it's going to be as if we evaluated them in order. So if X is 5, we're going to select the first input, giving us 1. If X is 0 or 6, we're going to select the second input, giving us 2. Then, if X is greater than 2, we're going to select the third input, giving us 3. And otherwise, we're going to select 4. And these are evaluated as if in order. So it acts like an if else-if, else-if, else-if. But the idea is in the hardware, we turn this into this structure where we have a mux, and the programming language, sort of hardware programming language implementation, figures out how to turn all our expressions into some logic that chooses the selection number, probably using the kind of tricks you saw in the bitwise homework. So in this example, if x is 5, well, we select the first thing. If x is 6, it's not equal to 5. It is in 0 and 6. We select that. There. Yes, there's something here that would also be true for 6, but we don't get there because we use the first option we find. If x is 3, it's not equal to 5. It's not 0 or 6. It is greater than 2, so we get 3, and so on. Questions here? Yes.
So you said that it picks the first one that it finds.
Yes. Yes, I said it picks the first one that it finds.
So order does matter.
So question, order does matter? Order does matter, yes. Yes.
Are those values like on the end? Are those just gonna be like the names and the inputs? You just want like 1, 2, 3, 4, just like an example.
So question, are the values 1, 2, 3, 4, could those be something else, like names of
it? Could be like the first input is 1, second input is 2, you could use like variable names that goes into the box for that.
Can I use variable names instead of 1, 2, 3, 4? Absolutely. You could, in fact, put any expression you want here. So you could have, like, say, the output of a register could go here, in which case, you know, I'd be putting a register's output there, or any other expression you want. That answer your question? Okay, other questions? Yeah?
If I'm understanding it, you're describing the mux, it looks like it's going basically from right to left, where the left is all the outputs, right, and all the decisions. Am I correct?
So the question, is the mux going from right to left? I didn't draw the output signal, but this is result here. So it's going from left to right in this picture.
So 1, 2, 3, 4, that's just kind of like storing it, and then the mux does all the conditions, and it just makes one, and then
is that? So question is 1, 2, 3, 4 kind of destroying it, and the mux does all the conditions and picks one? So I guess the way to put this is that we always compute 1, 2, 3, and 4. The mux chooses which of them we use. Yeah.
Why is x equals 3 and not 2?
Question, why is x equals 3 and x equals 4 and 3 and not 2? Aren't they in 0, 6? So this is a set of numbers. This is not a range. So this is specifically 0 or 6. So the question is, how many bits is x? So x could be any number of bits. The value that comes out of here, you know, which we won't see, but that hidden value would be 2 bits because we have 4 things to select from. Does that answer your question? Okay. Yes, back there. How does 1, 2, and 4 know we're trying to find out what x is? It doesn't. So that work in sort of this diagram is all being done here, that there's some box of logic that basically you can think of it as some, you know, our compiler is going to take these expressions and turn them into some description of logic, you know, like using bitwise and shifts, compare subtractions, additions, or whatever it needs to compute the value to select the input based on x. Does that answer your question? Yes, over there.
What happens if x is 2?
What happens if x is 2? Okay. So does x equal 5? Nope. Is x 0? Is 2 0 or 6? Nope. Is 2 greater than 2? Nope. Is true? Yes. 4. And 1 is a true value, 0 is a false value, like in C. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, thank you.
Yes.
So it's more the kind of like the L same as that. It's kind of a safety net that is like all the above.
Question is for the default here, that everything else false goes to there? Yes. Okay. So we know what these look like. Let's just double check. Who'd like some more time? Okay, so let's do the first one. Bar is 9. Who thinks foo is 100? 200? 300? Okay, 400. Some other value. Okay, so we have some disagreement there. So to see if bar is 9, we say is 9 greater than 10? And it is not. Then we ask if 9 ended with 1, equals 1. So this is bitwise AND, because it's a single ampersand. So let's think of 9 in binary. So 9 is equal to 1001 in base in binary. And if we AND that, bitwise AND that with 1, we have a bunch of leading zeros I didn't write in my 1. But I get 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, and so on. And this is going to be equal to 1. So this case is true, and we would get 200. And we stop looking. We found our answer. We stop looking. So questions on figure that out? OK. So how about if bar is 10. Let's do, who thinks we get 100? 200? 300? 400? Okay, we have greater consensus there. And how about if bar is 11? Who thinks we get 100? 200? 300? 400? No clue, something else? Okay, so we get 100, because now the first case doesn't matter. Okay. Questions about this? Okay. So we have things working with, we have muxes, so we can make decisions. Now let's implement nop and halt. So now our processor can stop. So if we think of a nop, it has the encoding 10. As its first byte, think of a halt, it has the encoding 00. And we're going to use this mux idea to decide using the opcode. So conceptually, what our circuit's going to look like is that we're going to take our instruction memory, we're going to get out the opcode, you know, this, by which I mean like this part here. And we're going to use that to decide what status to send. And that's going to tell the simulator whether to stop or keep going, so we'll finally be able to stop. Now, to do this, we need to figure out, well, how do we access that opcode part? How do we get that 0 or 1 value instead of all the rest of the 10 bytes the instruction memory is outputting? And to understand this, we need to think about, well, what is i10 bytes, that value which comes out of the instruction memory? What format does it have? You might say it's 10 bytes, so isn't it like an array? Well, no, it's a number, because all our values are numbers. It's an 80-bit number. But since it's an 80-bit number, and we got it from a memory of bytes, we have to worry about endianness to know how did we get from the bunch of bytes to the number. And it's little endian. So let's go through some examples of what that looks like. So here, let's say PC is 0, so I'm accessing address 0. I'm going to get the 10 bytes, so addresses 0 through 9, starting at PC. And because we're using little endian, the byte with the lowest address is going to be the one that's in our least significant place. So this value ends with 60. So if we're looking for the opcode, it is, you know, it would be right here, because it's going to be the most significant bits of the first byte. And if I, so that's where our first byte is, so our opcode is part of that least significant part of this number. And, you know, as we advance, we get to advance in memory, we get to more significant parts of the number up until the end. And if we have our PC equal to, say, 1, we'll get, you know, 10 bytes, but starting at address 1. And again, our first byte will be in the least significant part. So the opcode information we want, that's going to be in that least significant part of this number. So questions about how our numbers correspond to the contents of memory? Okay, so let's apply this. And to do this, well, we could do something where, like, we do a bunch of math operations on the 80-bit number to see if if that part of the lower hexadecimal digits has a particular value. But HCLRS provides you some ways of subsetting bits of a number. So you can use this syntax here, which is probably the most convenient, to get bits, in this case, 2 inclusive through 9 exclusive, where we're numbering the bits where the least significant bit is bit 0. So on this diagram, that would mean that bit 0 is over here, and bit 80, or 79, is over here. And this causes some consternation, because this may not match sort of the most natural way you think about how the instructions look in memory when you're encoding or decoding them. So let's say I have a push queue instruction. It's going to be represented as, for push queue RBX, as these two bytes. We have A0 and 2F. And what that meant when we went in our coding table is that at byte X plus 0 in memory, we have A0. And at byte X plus 1 in memory, we have 2F, or 2 for RBX, and F. And then after that, at byte x plus 2, we have whatever instructions after the push. If we think of how this turns into a number, our A0 becomes the least significant 8 bits of that number. And the A part of that number doesn't start at bit 0, it starts at bit 4. And our 2F became the next 8 bits in our numbering, so bits 8 through 16. And the 2 doesn't start at bit 8, it starts at bit 12. Questions at this point? Yes. So the question is the 2FA0 in little endian form. So I have, this is a number we have as a number, not as something which has sort of individual parts that would give us endian, yes? And I've written it so our least significant bit, which we're numbering 0, is rightmost. I'm not going to claim that that's little endian or something else, but our least, or big endian, I'm just going to say that on this slide, the rightmost thing is bit 0, which is the least significant bit. And the leftmost part is going to be bit 80, or really 79, which is the most significant bit. Other questions? Okay. So this means that if we think of our instruction encoding, that the way things work, bits 0 through 7 are this first byte. And if we want the bits 0 through 4, that's going to be where our secondary opcodes are, because that's the least significant part of that first byte, and we're starting from least significant. And 4 through 8 is we're going to be where our primary opcodes are, the ones we probably really want most of the time. And then bits 12 through 16, not 8 through 12, are where RA is, if we have an RA. And bits 8 through 12, not 12 through 16, are where RB is, if we have an RB. And because this doesn't go in, because as we go from left to right, things aren't strictly increasing, people find this very confusing and it causes lots of problems. Something that might help you think about this is that I could have written the same table I showed on the previous slide differently, like so, where I've just drawn it differently. So now it's still the same table, except I've put rightmost the lowest number, lowest address of the instruction, and leftmost the highest address of the instruction. Otherwise, it's exactly the same table. Represents the same information, but because I've done this, now if I go across this table, now the bits count in the same order they do when we're doing our bit indexing in HDLRS. So we have here bits 0 through 7. Again, this is bits 0 through 4, or secondary opcode, and now it's more obvious on this diagram that that would happen. And bits 4 through 8 are our primary opcode. Questions about our bit indexing here. Okay. So, with that, we can make both Knopf and Holt work. And I can do this by I can select the correct bits of our instruction, and I can compare them to the values we want. And HDLRS has some predefined constants to help you out. So I've written Knopf and Holt here. This is the same thing as writing 1 and 0, basically. They're just predefined constants for 1 and 0 because those are the values we have in our instruction code. So if I I have that CPU prepared here. So here's the processor, and I can run that on our knopf.yo, and you can see, oh, it says halted. And halts after fetching a halt instruction. You might say, wait a moment, we didn't write a halt instruction, if you remember the assembly from later. But we can see it fetched it from address 5, which is, if we look at our assembly file, so the address 5 it fetched it from is immediately after that. And that's just because uninitialized memory we set to zeros in our simulator, and zeros are halt. Very convenient. Questions? Out. Okay. So that's Knopf and Holt. So let's now support some more instructions. So we have Knopf and Holt. Let's add another instruction, which is jump, unconditional jump. So how can we do this? So right now, this is kind of our processor abstractly. We have this loop here, which increments our PC by 1. And then we get our flip and we get the primary opcode and use that to decide how stat is sent, whether we keep going or not. And I have this box labeled split, which just represents extracting the 4 bits we care about from the 80-bit instruction memory value. So to add jump to this, I'm going to rearrange this diagram slightly. It's the same diagram. And if we're implementing a jump, what do we want to do differently on a jump? So on a jump, we want the next PC not to be plus 1, but to be something else. So we have to make a decision. And our prior solution when we had to make a decision was to add this mux idea, which we represented with a case expression. So we're going to do the same thing here. We're going to have a mux, which is going to choose between the value we wanted for the nop instruction and whatever value we want for jump. We have to figure out how do we compute the value for jump. So to figure that out, we can go back to our diagram here. Jump to destination, well, there's our destination. So we're going to want to extract it from the instruction memory output. So we're going to have, you know, our dest, which we also extract from by subsetting the bits of i10 bytes. And then we're going to have a mux, where there's some logic we're not going to actually implement, but that's going to like take our opcode and turn it into 0 or 1, depending on which input we want to select. We want to do the nop case or the jump case. And here's sort of some code for that. And I've also done some things here that are probably convenient things to do when we're writing HTLRS code for as they get bigger. So one thing I've done is I've defined some kind of convenience value. So I have this value called iCode, which I put the primary opcode into. I'm using the names from the book. I don't think iCode is the best name for it, but it's the name our book uses, and I want it to be consistent if you're looking at the book. And I have this name valp for the signal that we eventually send into the new program counter value. That's, again, taken from the book. I would not call it valp because that's not a great name, but I want you to be consistent with the reading. So we have here, we have our mux. And you can see that one of our inputs to our mux is the value we choose for the PC for a nop. And that's going to be PC plus 1. And that's represented right here. If our iCode is the value for nop, PC plus 1. Another of the values is the value for the jump. And that's going to be, turns out, bits 80 to 72 of the instruction, which I've put in this sort of named wire called dest, just so I can refer to it conveniently, and that's what we're sending in that case. And I also have this third case here, and there's a rule in HTLRS that all muxes have to have a default, so we know what to do if something goes wrong. So in this case, I've chosen a default value that will show up really nicely on the output. So I know if it gets chosen, because I didn't expect that to happen. Other questions so far? Yeah. So the question is, what is the split box just divides between the destination and the actual rest of the instruction? Yes, so the split box here is representing the sort of bit subsetting operations I'm doing here. Okay, other questions? Yes.
How do you get like nop and JXX from the i10 bytes?
How do I get nop and JXX from the i10 bytes 4 and 8? So nop here, this is the constant. This constant, and JXX is whatever the, I would need to remember what the constant number is 7. So the JXX here, that's going to be 0B0101. This is just a predefined constant, so you could also just write that number there instead. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
So this is only for non-conditional jumps, right?
Question, this is only for non-conditional jumps? That's correct. Other questions? Yeah.
Why does dest not need to go through the conditional box like iCode?
Question, why does dest not need to go through the conditional box like the iCode? You mean, why is dest not on the left side of the colons?
Yeah, both in the colon and on the diagram.
So, if we think of What this mux is doing, it's choosing one of these values. It doesn't need to know, to make that choice, it doesn't need to know anything about dest. It just knows it's choosing one of them. So that, and the things before the colon here are representing how it makes that choice. So we choose which of the two which of the two values come out of the mux without using the dest. We only use the iCode.
So
the value which comes out is the dest, but that's just because the mux is choosing either to make this connection or to make this connection. And the stuff before the colon here, this stuff here, that's the information about how to make the decision about which of those two connections to make. Okay, other questions? Okay, and we also have some stuff to set the program counter. And I've chosen to do something here where my default program counter value is this constant INS. That's like halt, except the simulator will print invalid instruction instead of halted. So, can. Yeah. So, we could run that. So, if we want to run this, we need to have some assembly file that we could demonstrate, so we could do something like this one, which I should have prepared. And yeah. So we'll show that here. Okay. So we have our, so we'll make jump.ys. Correct name, and then I have my not jump CPU, the one we just showed. So we can run that, and we can see that if we look at the output it had, you can see that we loaded the NOP, we loaded a jump that's said to go to address 13, and we correctly, after that, we load address. I should be here. 13, which says to jump to A, address A. Then we load from address A. And you can see we load because we set the PC appropriate, which says to go to 1C. We go to 1C. We loaded a NOP there. And then we went to 1E because instruction after the NOP. And we loaded the halt, and that's when we halted. So there's some other stuff that HCRS can do I want you to be aware of. So one option is that there's this debug option. And what does that do? So it prints out, after every step, the values of every single signal, every single wire that's named. It also prints out sort of exactly how i10 bytes was set, but prints out all the wires. So if you wrote some HCRS program and you're wondering what's going on, this is a way to help find out. You might say, well, gosh, this is an awful lot of output to scroll through. What can I do about that? So one thing you can do is you could, save this to a file somewhere. So, but another thing you can do is that there's also an interactive option, which will ask you after every cycle whether to keep going. So you need to press enter to actually keep going. So just things I want you to be aware of for our next lab, where we're actually going to be using that. Oh, and also there's a -q option for --quiet. Which will only print the output at the end. This is useful for quickly testing something, but probably not what you want to do for debugging. Like, not knowing anything that happened in the middle seems less than ideal. OK, so now we've done a bunch of manipulation. Yes, sorry, for a moment.
Sorry, I know this was already talked about, but would you mind repeating about basically how to understand what
What is the box telling you? So we have the values of registers, which we haven't yet talked about how to access. That's going to be our next topic. But the registers are kind of built into our simulator. We don't, as in the registers like RAX, those registers are built into our simulator. We have the value of the register we defined, called the PC. That's because it's in our code. And we have the contents of memory. And the contents of memory are rich, so address 0, 0 is here, address 0, say 9 is here.
Okay, so it's just, so after every cycle, it's just updating us on what information we have.
Question after every cycle gives you all this information? Yes.
Okay.
Other questions? Okay. So let's talk about adding some additional useful instructions. So we'll start with add. So add, the encoding is 60 and 2 4-bit register number, register indices. And let's talk about making a CPU that only does add, just to keep things as simple as possible. But to do this, we need to access the registers. And one thing we could have had you do is we could have had you, implement all the registers yourself by making, you know, register something and RAX 64 equals 0 and so on. But that's not how things are going to work. We've implemented this functionality for you in a component we call a register file, which is similar to something that, you know, in typical processor, someone will implement this separately from the rest of the processor. And the processor will use it through an interface like the one we're going to talk about. So the register file has a that we're going to provide you has a whole bunch of inputs and a whole bunch of outputs. And you can think of it as like it contains a whole lot of registers, and it figures out how to get their values and set their values based on how we set these inputs and outputs. So for reading a register, it kind of works like the instruction memory. We put in a register index to read, and we, in the same cycle, get the value of that register. So kind of like with the instruction memory, we put in the address to read, we get the value at that address here, we put in the index of a register. So 0 for RAX, 1 for RCX, and so on. And we get the value of RAX or RCX. So we can think of it as when we set the register number input, sometime later, this register file outputs on a corresponding output the value stored in that register right now. We can also write registers. And the way that works is that we have to put in the value we want to write, just like a plain register where we don't have to specify which one. And we also have to put in which one we want to write to. So if I want to write to RAX, so it's R8, let's say, I'll put an 8 here and say 100 here. And that would mean that at the rising edge of the clock, we'd have R8, which I should write legibly-ish. So R8 becomes 100. It would happen at the next rising edge of the clock. So that means that we'd set the values in one cycle, and they'd actually be stored at the beginning of the next cycle. You know, we wouldn't be able to actually, if we read the register, if we read R8 when we had this set up, we wouldn't read 100 yet. We were at 100 in the next clock cycle, after the rising edge. Question?
Explain again, what do these colors represent?
Question, what do these colors represent? The colors represent different values. So some value that's changed. So in this case, like the register previously had the blue value, and I specify which one to change, it's going to have the green value for the rising edge of the clock.
Then what is the shaded?
What is the shaded? That represents the input is changing because, remember, in the middle of a clock cycle, the values can be unstable until we've waited long enough.
Gone.
Question? Yes?
What
is the difference between the register number input and the data input? So the register number, this is going to be our table of values where we had like 0 for RAX, 1 for RCX, 8 for R8, and 9 for R9, and so on. So the register numbers are the index in that table. So think of them kind of like the equivalent of an address for our registers. The register values are the actual 64-bit number we want to put in the register. Does that answer your question? Yes, back there? So the question is, if we store the value right at the rising edge of the clock cycle, the value wouldn't change to the next rising edge? So the way I think about it is, before a rising edge, we will set up a write, and it will happen at the rising edge. So we can read after it happens to get the new value. Yeah?
Just to make sure, it doesn't matter what the data input has if we're doing a read, right? Like, we don't need to clear that line.
So the question is, are the reads independent of the data inputs? Yes. So you can think of, we have a bunch of pairs of inputs. So we'll have a read register number that's paired with a register value and another set of that, because we need to have instructions that need to read two registers. And we have a register number to write that's paired with a specific value it uses and another one. We could write two registers at the same time. Why can we do that? Because pop needs to do that. Okay. So something you might notice is a little bit of a problem here is that the way I've told you this works, it looks like that I have a signal putting in a register number to write and a value. And let's say I don't want to change any registers. I can't do that, it seems like, because I have to always put in a register number to change. So to help us out with this, we have the special register number 15, register index 15 is special, and it means don't change anything. So this is why we don't have register 15. So register 14 works normally. Register 15, if we write it, it does nothing. And if we read it, we get 0. And all these signals here have names in HTLRS. So if we want to read, say, from register 8, we'll set our reg sort, we can set reg source A to 8, and then reg output A will be the value of register 8. And if we want to say set register 9 to 100, we can set reg desd to 9 and reg input E to 100, and this would mean that at next rising edge, edge, R9 becomes 100. Some questions? Here, yes.
Sorry, I didn't fully understand what the problem with register number 15 is trying to solve.
What problem is register number 15 trying to solve? So let's say I have an expression that says regdesd, and I have like the value I want to write to it, but let's say I don't want to write, right? I have my case for, say, if my instruction is a NOP. I need a way of writing that case. And right now, there's no if I don't have register 15, there's no value I can put in there. Because all my values will do things that NOP shouldn't do, which is change registers, values. Does that answer your question? So because the problem is, if once we set regdesd, it's always set, right? It's connected to something. We need a way of having it have a value which doesn't do anything. Or else our instructions will always change a register, even though we know not all instructions should do that. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah. So the question, does register 15 exist to have a specific purpose or does it not exist at all? Either interpretation is okay. Okay, so using this, we can build a processor that does adds. So we'll take in our program counter to read the instruction memory, and this time we need to get out our two register indices. So like if it's register add R8 and R9, this is going to be 8 and 9. it tells us where to add from and put the result. We're going to read those two register values, so we're going to pass our numbers, say, 8 and 9, if it's R8 and R9, to get the values, which we're going to take out of these, outputs, to get these two values, and then we're going to add them together, and we're going to store that result in our corresponding sort of write input. So we're going to tell which register to write with dest. So which register and what to write. What to write. Yes?
So this all happens on one rising clock?
So the question is, this design would all happen in one rising clock? Yes.
But it doesn't get written to the destination register until the next one?
Question, it doesn't get written until the next destination register, the next one? Yes. So I guess to make this clearer, if this is our clock cycle, here, this is when we have a new PC. So sometime after that, like the instruction memory will read a value, then we'll, sort of do our actual work, and it should be the case before the end of that next rising edge, we'll have the value set up to write, and they won't change until that next rising edge. Does that answer your question?
Yes. Thank
you. Yeah. So the question is, doesn't this sort of design mean where we're executing every instruction in a single cycle, and that's the processor designs we're going to start with, doesn't that mean that if, say, this add operation is really complicated, doesn't that mean our clock cycle gets slower? Absolutely. And that might be a reason we want to explore other designs. Okay, so if we think of how this works, let's say our instructions are add RAX RDX, add RBX RDX. So if we run this now, we'll get initially, say, RAX is 10, RBX is 20, RDX is 30. We'll take RAX plus RDX, and we'll read 10 and 30. So we'll have 0 as source A, 2 as source B. So we'll get 10 as the value of RAX, 30 as the value of RDX, and we'll have prepared the value 40 for next cycle. And then in the next cycle, our value will change. Questions here? Okay. And then what happens after that? Well, I forgot something on the circuit. We probably want to actually also set the new PC. And this is the code we get for that. And I think I'm out of time. So we'll just leave this here for you to look at later. And we'll talk about it next week.